Welcome back to Paris Lesbos. We are uprooting to an entirely different place this episode, one we haven't actually had anyone from till now, Mexico. You may have seen the movie about her a while back. Today we're doing Frida Kahlo, and I would like to preface this by saying this is not an episode to listen to when driving or otherwise operating machinery if you are prone to fainting from body horror. Also, content warning for suicide.
So, a really fun, cheerful episode this time.
Though she was born in July 1907, Kahlo would always claim to have been born in 1910, so that she could be the same age as the modern Mexico that rose out of the 1910 revolution.
And not just so she could, you know, seem younger.
Though, I forget if we've done any of the women yet who actually, as time went on, started to de-age themselves this way.
But no, Kahlo's doing this for, like, ideological reasons.
Very much so. Her father was a German immigrant with an unfortunate epileptic condition, and who was persuaded by his second wife, Frida's mother, to become a photographer. Frida would be their third daughter out of four, though her father had two daughters from his first wife, the one that had died in childbirth, hence the second marriage. And then there's that revolution we mentioned earlier.
Yeah, about that. Sounds like it was a big deal.
Several armies formed into one under the famous Pancho Villa. May 1911 saw the fall of the then dictator of Mexico, and the revolution's leader was elected president in 1912. But then there were also 10 days of bombing between two groups in 1913, so it's rather messy. For our purposes, though, supposedly Kahlo witnessed some battles, as the family did live in Mexico City at the time. But as these accounts were written not long before she died, take them all with several grains of salt, because she was about 5 at the time of them happening to.
Or 3. Or 2. I've lost track of the math.
She was approximately 5 years old.
According to some biographers.
According to a 1907 birth date.
Yeah, well.
Either way, later on she would write about those 10 days and how she could remember bullets zipping by and seeing a wounded rebel running in the street. I rather doubt her parents let her out of the central part of the house or a basement if they had one during that, so who knows how accurate such stories are.
I'm sure they're accurate to how she was feeling at the time. I would, you know, regardless of whether you're, like, in the house or not, I'd be very scared.
I imagine so, but Kahlo would later come to view the revolution positively. Her parents, on the other hand, did not. Her father had had commissions from the Mexican government that went poof into nothing overnight. They were now in poverty with no prospects. Not long after Kahlo started school, the 6-year-old was then stricken with polio.
As if the poverty and violence weren't enough.
She spent 9 months confined to her room with pain in her right leg. In fact, polio can leave one crippled for life, as the affected limbs will wither away both from the illness and the lack of any real movement to strengthen the muscles. Now, her father was typically a man of few words, but he became unusually involved and concerned after the onset of her illness, possibly feeling a kinship due to his own disability. So when the doctor finally recommended sports to try and counteract the withering of the right leg, Kahlo's father made sure she did all of the sports: soccer, boxing, wrestling, swimming, climbing trees, and riding bikes.
Wow, she's doing everything. Now, is this something that girls do at the time?
No, keep in mind, this is roughly 1914. These are not sports women do. Just a few years prior, Paris was in an uproar over women biking in parks because of how it made their skirts bounce, and there would still be a minor scandal over women boxing in 1920s Berlin in the near future.
And Mexico wasn't any different from these European countries.
I very much doubt it. There's still a lot of the same social attitudes. And keep in mind, this is only a few decades after waves of German immigrants and other immigration that Callow's own father was a part of that came from Europe to Mexico.
Gotcha. So you get a lot of that European culture going around here.
Yes, though that's not to say it was all European culture that would influence her. As you can see from her art later on that we will discuss, there's a lot of Mexican native influence. Now, despite this regime of athletics, her leg remained thin, which, children being dicks, led to teasing and later bullying. They called her peg leg, which caused her to fake a healthy-looking leg by wearing 4 long socks at once on one leg. Another side effect was loneliness, both from being confined by illness for almost a year and then from the subsequent bullying. There was a positive from this. Callow became her father's favorite. He let her spend time in his studio, encouraged her adventurousness, introduced her to hobbies and academic subjects, and taught her photography. I'd be surprised if this didn't influence her towards painting after the accident she had as a teen.
Wow, yeah, so it sounds like there's, although this is awful, at least she has some outlet for her creativity during this time.
But in the meantime, 14-year-old Callow entered the best Mexican educational institute in 1922. After all, the cream of Mexican youth, the future national leaders, attended it. However, girls had only just been allowed attendance when she started. In fact, she was one of only 35 in a student body of 2,000.
Dang, that is outnumbered. And now how's she getting into this educational institute? Weren't they, like, super poor?
Yeah, but I imagine her father still had connections from the previous government. Some people probably survived the whole revolution upheaval.
Gotcha. And, yeah, so I guess he encouraged her to do sports. Was he also encouraging of her, like, academic pursuits, despite her being a girl?
Yes. And it's thought that this is partly allowed and wanted on his part because he had no son, and he filled the void of traditional hopes by intending his favorite daughter to become educated and gain a profession. This did not mean that Callow was the most easy to deal with student. She quickly scorned the unspoken rule for girls to spend any free time in one area of the school, meaning that girls were basically confined to just one area of the school while the boys roamed the rest of the grounds. Instead, she threw herself into the social whirl of clubs, a whirl almost entirely full of boys, but being a tomboy who found the other girls petty and boring, she didn't mind this. She would eventually have a very tight-knit group of friends that did end up having 2 girls in it, because apparently they were different from the others.
Well, that sounds like the common thread is rebelling against the gender roles that have been put upon them, so sounds like a good group.
I mean, I'm not very surprised on Callow's part. There are photos of her in suits.
But not from this time, right?
No, from a bit later.
All right, let me know when we get to the suit part.
Now, if only the academic side was as much of a success as the social. Sadly, despite devouring books, Callow didn't care for putting in effort, which, to be honest, why bother when she got high marks with ease? I'm pretty sure a lot of people in school have felt the same. Still, she was known to skip class if she felt the lecturers put in too little effort, so she turned into a talented problem child from the school system perspective.
I love this. I love the, like, confidence here. I feel like this really presages, like, the way that she acts through the rest of her life.
It was during this time that Callow and her friends played pranks on the established painter Diego Rivera when he did a mural in the school's auditorium. This included stealing food from his lunch basket and generally being disruptive by trying to cause rifts in his relationships with his mistress and models by making it seem as if he was cheating. There are rumors that this is when Callow decided she'd marry him or at least have him as a boyfriend one day. But press X to doubt here because this is all said decades later and we've already seen facts tweaked a bit in this narrative before.
Yeah, I mean, she's a fairly famous person and a lot of what she does in her art is make stories about her own life. And I could see where this Too Many Outsiders and maybe even her presents a neat sort of foreshadowing, even if maybe at the time it wasn't there.
In the meantime, she already had a boyfriend about 3 years older than her and who was also a student at the school. It was this boyfriend who was with Callow during the horrifying bus and trolley accident in 1925 when she was only 18. And it's his account the story of the accident mainly comes from. Suffice it to say that a trolley slammed into the bus they were riding on, an accident that was common at the time as buses were new and everyone drove as if they were invincible. The impact ripped Callow's clothes off and someone's bag of gold dust had gone flying up into the air, so the stuff coated her, but the real problem was the metal rod that her boyfriend then pulled out of her body as the ambulance arrived.
Oh yeah, ouch!
In fact, the account goes on to state that her scream was so loud it drowned out the ambulance siren. From there, she was rushed to the Red Cross Hospital, where it turned out her spine was broken in 3 parts, 2 ribs were broken, her collarbone was broken, her right leg, the one withered from polio, had 11 fractures, her right foot was dislocated, her left shoulder broken, her pelvis broken, and herself torn from abdomen to vagina. Now take a moment to think of something else if you also have an overactive imagination and are prone to fainting like I am. You took a moment? Good. So anyway, she would joke later that that is how she lost her virginity.
Oof. I mean, what is there to say? This is just the most awful thing. Like, ouch! There's no words for that.
It was a miracle Callow lived, let alone later regained the ability to walk. Now, her boyfriend was also injured, but he could at least recover at home. She would be stuck in the hospital for a month, where at night she wondered if she had in fact died and this was just a strange sort of limbo she was stuck in.
Yeah, I mean, I would too. That sounds just horrific.
Sadly, the relationship did not survive the distance brought by the time needed for recovery from the accident, as Callow now was only confined to her house rather than the hospital after that stay. While her recovery seemed remarkable, there would be relapses, including 3 months later when she was back in Mexico City. And if you are familiar with the movie on her life, these relapses weren't really shown. So the first one came a year after the accident, where it was discovered parts of her spine were out of place. The treatment for it was immobilizing her in plaster. And if you're wondering why this is, it turns out the doctors at the hospital hadn't done x-rays and hadn't really paid attention to her spine.
Which is a weird choice on their part. You'd think you'd check.
You'd think, but considering the list of injuries, I can see how a nurse or someone would have missed things here and there, but
they're trying to fix every other part of her. I guess they forgot to look at the spine.
I don't know. I'm not a medical professional. All I know is this was only the beginning of her troubles. She would suffer from chronic pain and fatigue for the rest of her life and routinely underwent surgery to try and compensate for or fix the injured parts of her body. As one friend put it, Callow spent her life dying. The plaster treatment resulted in her having to learn to keep still. And this is where she turns to painting. Callow readily admitted that her first attempts were bad. She was not one to promote any sort of artistic myth of talent and so forth, no. It took time and a lot of practice to develop her abilities, but she had both of these resources in plenty since she was lying on a bed immobilized.
I'm impressed that she was even able to move enough to do the painting. I mean, I feel like if you're moving like your arms, then that also affects your back and all of that.
Again, neither of us are medical professionals, But from what little I know, I think if you do very little movement, it probably doesn't really move your back all that much, especially depending on what parts of her spine were out of place.
That makes sense. I could see that. And also, I'm sure, like, from a harm reduction perspective, better that she's moving a little bit to be painting than, like, you know, she's a pretty active person before then, so I imagine she wanted to do a lot more things.
Oh, yeah, I can just imagine the levels of frustration going from very athletic and social to confined in your bedroom. And it's during this time, partially because she is confined to her bedroom, she only really paints both herself and her friends, and it's thought that painting then becomes a means of control. Her body was no longer capable of certain things, and she had lost quite a lot of control over her life because of the accident and all of the injuries that she would have to deal with after this. But through her art, she could project a version of herself that was in her mind. She could put that self onto the canvas, and it was a version that was still very much in control. Also, and I feel like this is always stated with any art or creation, but it is quite true, making art is always a way to deal with emotions, trauma, confusion, and literally anything and everything. And there's probably something to do with endorphin boosts after finishing a project, but I am merely a writer, not a scientist.
That makes sense, though. I mean, you have that double thing of being able to control some aspect of your life and actually being able to accomplish something despite this, like, horrific event that just happened.
But moving on. By 1927, Callow had recovered enough to lead an almost normal, active life. This did not mean she returned to school. Turns out she was dealing with way too much pain in order to actually go back to school. Instead, she focused on her painting. But this did not mean she became a recluse. If she had, she'd have never gone to a party and met the painter Diego Rivera.
For the second time.
Properly met this time, rather than just harassing him from the shadows with a group of other teenagers.
Right. Met as an adult.
Well, there's no harassing at this party. However, Rivera does shoot a phonograph during a dispute with someone during this event.
Wonderful. Great impression to make on her. Not just an acclaimed artist, but also...
From there, they basically started dating. But his wife, whom he had separated from but was still technically married to, was annoyed by this.
Why? What right does she have?
Relationships are complicated.
Fair enough.
This didn't stop Callow from joining Rivera while he worked and then getting engaged in 1928. Many urged her to marry him as he was rich and famous, which probably eased worries her father had as he struggled to pay Callow's medical bills, which he knew would only continue. Her mother had a fit, though, which is understandable as her 21-year-old daughter wanted to marry an ugly, fat, 42-year-old communist atheist, as she put it. For a highly religious woman, who knows which descriptor was worse?
Yeah, so you've presented a lot of reasons why you've presented reasons why she should marry him and reasons why she shouldn't. Do we have any sense of her perspective on the matter?
She wanted to marry him.
Not just because he was rich and famous?
Not just because he was rich and famous. They got on rather well, though it is not the healthiest of relationships, as we will see. It's rather complicated, but for instance, later on there would be a story someone told when they were out with the two of them and got separated in this crowded bar or something. And everyone else is starting to worry and even panic a bit because they can't find Frida. And Rivera just starts whistling. And through the crowd, you can hear an answering whistle. And the two just walk through this crowd whistling to find each other.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Okay. Thank you. That gives me the context I needed.
So they do marry in 1929. By now, Rivera is single again, so there's no bigamy.
Excellent. Great precondition for a marriage.
The marriage does limit Callow's painting for a time, as she is now playing the role of a wife of a supposed genius who couldn't take care of himself when sick, fell asleep while working, and then fell off the scaffold where he was working as a result of falling asleep.
Interesting. How is this working for her? I mean, isn't she still, like, somewhat disabled, or...
She is, but the thing is, she never lets it stop her, and she's still young enough that there's not a lot of complications completely crippling her. It's also not like she's running all over the place. It's more of a walking pace and constantly being in pain.
Gotcha. So, like, completely chill.
On the outside, yes. Now, as to playing the role of wife, she actually enjoyed fussing over him at times. She also tended to join him when he was painting murals, which is probably good education to watch someone else in your medium while they work. However, not all was well. When she became pregnant in 1930, she had an abortion because the baby was in the wrong position, which wasn't viable for survival of the kid, Callow, or both of them. It's a bit unclear. This cycle of having abortions or miscarriages would actually become a recurring theme of her life, unfortunately. Due to the trolley accident, she couldn't have a biological child, though a doctor in 1932 suggested she might be able to have one via C-section despite a broken pelvis and spine.
That seems a bit optimistic.
It was, but it was an optimism she seized upon, as we will see. At the time, though, in 1930, her mood is not helped by Rivera having an affair with his assistant. It was perhaps at this time that she said, "I suffered two great accidents in my life, one in which a streetcar knocked me down. The other accident is Diego." So there's a love-hate relationship there.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, when she met him all those many years ago, he was, you know, had mistresses and whatever. So I don't know that this is too much of a shock, but still, come on, Diego.
It is also in 1930 that Callow and her husband traveled to California as he got work in the U.S. During this time, she fully returned to painting portraits, especially when she was physically limited by a flare-up of foot trouble caused by that trolley accident.
Now, do we know what style she's using for the portraits or what inspirations she's drawing from?
The style is very much her own. Some have called her a surrealist. Others have said it's more realist. So more realism. There's debates in two camps on that. But there's, over time, a fair amount of influences about Mexico with the sort of clothing styles, the colors, other symbols. There's also just a lot of self-portraits.
Yeah, so it sounds like she kind of has her own unique style.
It is. It has been called unique, exceptional, and disturbing.
Well, there you have it.
Now, 1930, from California, they end up in New York because someone had a retrospective of Rivera's work at the Museum of Modern Art there. And then they end up in Detroit again because of his work. It is in Detroit that she is pregnant again. And here is where there's a great deal of back and forth on her part on whether to have another abortion. In the end, she decided to try the C-section route that was suggested to her by an American doctor, despite Rivera's worries for her health and the fact he didn't want another kid. He'd already had four with different women.
Oh yeah, that's a lot of children.
Callow, though, very much wanted a child, and she was very optimistic when talking to this doctor about the chances. Her optimism was not successful. She had a miscarriage in July 1932 that resulted in a 13-day hospital stay.
Oof, that sounds rough. I think it's fine if she doesn't have a kid, because that sounds like it is doing too much to her body.
Yeah, but there's a lot of grief here, so This time she would cope by painting what the fetus would have looked like right before the miscarriage, but Callow very much wanted to have a child, specifically Rivera's child. According to him, she would try another 3 times, and each time ended in either miscarriage or an abortion due to her health. So she never had a kid, and while she did end up being an aunt who naturally doted on her nieces and nephews as a form of compensation for not having a kid, she would also end up having a large doll collection, and then a doctor in 1941 would gift her a fetus in a jar of formaldehyde. So there's a lot of weird macabre-ness going on there as well.
Yeah, now she didn't ever adopt?
No, because as stated previously, Rivera did not want another child. He was not going to agree to adopt one for her, and she can't survive on her own financially, as we will see. But back to 1932. Callow became depressed after the miscarriage and the hospital to stay. She picked at her food and wanted to die in her grief. She obviously didn't, as the episode doesn't end here. Instead, she got back into painting and her husband went off and had another affair.
Come on.
An added strain was that she wanted to go back to Mexico and he didn't. Instead, 1933 saw them back in New York. It was only in 1934 that they returned to Mexico. But all is not well with this move, as Rivera now has an affair with Callow's own sister, Christina.
Really?
Yeah, not much is known about this affair, when it ended, how long it lasted. It may have been in response to his sulking at being back in Mexico, which he blamed Callow for. Either way, this resulted in the two separating for a time.
Yeah, no kidding.
This is not to say that everything was going wrong for her. You see, it wasn't as if she hadn't had affairs of her own.
Oh?
In fact, Rivera had at times encouraged Callow's affairs with women.
Really?
Yeah, some gossiped it was because he couldn't keep up with a woman who said things like life was make love, take a bath, make love again.
Ooh, scandalous.
Yeah, and I don't quite know whether to admire this coming from a woman who would joke that her virginity was taken by a handrail.
See, I was thinking that she's had so much suffering in her life that if she wants life to be about make love, take a bath, make love again, like, she's earned it. Like, good for her, you know? Or not even earned it. She's had enough suffering. Let her make love, take a bath, and make love again.
Well, that is true. I was wondering about how that is affected by medical conditions.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, there is confusion here when going through what I can tell you is far too many biographies to find any traces of this, as Pixie, you are very aware from me texting you internal screaming of ah. Because despite many saying she was bisexual and never hid her affairs, there's a lot that just doesn't really mention it or doesn't go into detail. There's like one paragraph in one several hundred page book, and this seems worse than the random list paragraph we had for Delenn's episode. But anyway, possibilities include actresses Maria Felix, who, by the way, once played La Belle Otero in a film. And then there's the actress Dolores Del Rio, Paulette Goddard, whom Callow's husband also had an affair with, and then the Costa Rican singer Chavela Vargas.
Who, by the way, side note, beautiful singer, definitely look her up.
Despite said rumors, Callow preferred men to women. Hence, we come to the Trotsky affair.
What? I'm sorry, what? Like Trotsky?
Yeah, the whole communist Russian Trotsky.
I mean, everyone knows about Frida Kahlo, right? But I did not know this.
Well, Rivera is a communist. Also part of the reason how Frida herself would actually join the Communist Party in Mexico. And he very much admired Trotsky. The two would then meet when the Russian was in exile in Mexico in 1936, and naturally, Callow also met with him. The affair started with him slipping notes into book recommendations for her, and then led to secret meetings at her sister Christina's house. I'm assuming she's patched things up with Christina at this point, and that her affair with Callow's husband has ended by now.
One would hope, but honestly, this whole thing sounds so complicated.
The Trotsky affair, though, would only last a handful of months, and they would end up close friends instead.
Honestly, that sounds ideal. It starts with him recommending you books, and you have a nice little affair, and then you're just friends. Like, great.
By 1939, Callow's work had gained attention, and an exhibition was arranged in Paris. As mentioned last episode, she and Josephine Baker had an affair during this trip, but Callow was also worried about Rivera and longed for Mexico. It was not exactly a triumphant return, as she was soon divorced.
What, now?
Yes, she and Rivera got divorced. You seem confused.
I feel like they've had their marital struggles beforehand. Why is this the turning point for them?
It seems to have just kept building up. And things came to a head and they got divorced. And while a few affairs followed, she remarried Rivera the next year.
All right, then.
This was not without drama, as this was pretty much right after she was under suspicion for the assassination of Trotsky, as she had met the assassin in Paris and he had befriended Callow after several months of trying.
I'm so sorry, what?
Yeah, she befriended Trotsky's assassin in Paris and she didn't know that, and he followed her back to Mexico where he assassinated Trotsky because they knew each other and she introduced them.
What? So wait, he wasn't like a paid assassin, he was just like some guy who decided to assassinate Trotsky, or I don't know anything about Trotsky.
It sounds like it was a setup, and he was trying to get to Trotsky, and so he had to go through friends of his, and Callow was just the unfortunate one who got duped.
Oh no!
But because of that, the police ended up ransacking her house.
Fun times!
As to the remarriage, it came about because everything was complicated between feelings and medical bills, and Callow can't actually manage to live on her own because of said bills, and selling art didn't make much money.
I mean, fair enough.
So now she remarried Diego, and the 1940s saw an uptick in the momentum of her career. There was a prize, a fellowship, invitations to write articles, participation in cultural conventions, and people asking her to teach them.
Wow, okay, so she has made it.
Despite the fact that Mexico joined the Allied side of World War II in 1942, the war didn't have much of an effect on her life. After all, Mexico didn't so much fight as it provided raw materials to the U.S. war effort.
So we're not going to have the, like, big World War II sound effect here. We're just going to be like, whatever. It was happening in the background.
I don't know if I should have a sound effect for this or even a sound effect for the Mexican Revolution.
maybe have a sound effect for the Mexican Revolution.
You're having me come up with so many sound effects.
I'm so sorry. You started it, though.
We constantly were talking about World War I. It was every single episode.
Fair enough.
However, by 1945, Callow's health had worsened more than usual. There were a few points where she struggled to breathe because the corset made to help her injured spine would harden and start to crush her lungs.
Oh, that's a fun problem to have.
And there were also more surgeries and more pain, and it was about this time that her body was becoming too frail for at least penetrative sex, so there went men for her.
Wow. That's rough. So on top of everything else, she can't have, like, one of the nice things that she had had.
No, she has to go from one flavor to another. 1950 proved even worse. Kalo woke to find 4 black toes on her troubled right foot, because it turns out she had caught gangrene. This led to a year-long hospital stay. While she was eventually well enough to be discharged, her health continued to suffer. Despite this, she continued to paint, and in 1953, there was the first major exhibition of her work in her native Mexico, and it was a solo exhibition.
It wasn't as Diego Rivera's wife.
It was not. It was very much as Frida Kahlo. Kahlo herself was not expected to attend, as many believed her close to death, but she actually had people carry her bed to the exhibition in order to be present at it.
Beautiful.
To her, it was a triumph. From her place lying down in bed, she held court like the pictures of lavishly gowned saints that adorn the walls of Mexican churches. People drank in her honor. Someone read a poem composed for her. That being said, the night was described as one that was as macabre as it was joyous, because all of the crippled and ill people also came to see her success. I suspect because, despite herself being crippled quite severely by this point, this is very much a success for her. She did all of the work leading up to this after the accident, despite everything that happened.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm just going to say, people saying that it was Cobb because there are ill people there, like, them's fighting words.
Overall, though, the night was a resounding success. Sadly, Kahlo didn't live long after it. In August 1953, doctors decided to amputate her right leg, as the cocktail of drugs she was on was doing nothing for it, and she'd already lost a few toes during this battle. Naturally, she screamed no at the suggestion. Her friends and Rivera had to coax her into going along with the operation by saying she could get a peg leg and would then be able to walk again, because at this point the leg didn't do anything but exist and cause her pain.
Oof, yeah, I could see where that would be a good choice to amputate, but also, I mean, imagine losing your leg.
Yeah, it's a huge emotional, psychological impact, more even than it is physical. And this led to many sketches of amputated limbs in her diary as a way to cope. Despite that, after the amputation, she still became deeply depressed. Several friends and Rivera said she lost the will to live after that, which is rather true, seeing as she tried to commit suicide in a hospital bathroom, though she regretted the attempt not long after. Months later, Kahlo learned how to walk with a prosthetic, which she hid under decorated cloth, as she hated looking at the thing.
This whole situation just sounds miserable.
It is, because despite all of that, the operation did not prevent the weight loss and loss of circulation in her body. She was still slowly dying. She spiraled down into a loss of physical and mental control due to the deterioration of her body and the cocktail of drugs given for her problems, which all led to accidents, which then led to hospital stays in a vicious cycle like a snake eating its tail. Now, Kahlo wasn't oblivious. She knew she was dying. She planned her cremation as she didn't want to be put into the ground, lying down, the same position she'd spent too long in during hospital stays and illnesses. She went about organizing her life, celebrated her birthday the day before it was to occur, and then she committed suicide on July 13th, 1954, at age 47. It was reported as a pulmonary embolism, but suicide is a likely end considering the pain she was in and the fact she knew she was dying. There's also the testimony of the nurse who attended her and who did believe Kahlo had committed suicide due to evidence of self-tampering with her treatment. Her body was then laid in state before the funeral the next day. And while the funeral was small with only friends and family, hundreds stood outside as it went on. After the ceremony, her body was cremated as per her wishes. Her ashes were then put in a cedar box, and Rivera asked that when he died, his ashes be mixed with hers. That never happened, as people thought he should be buried amongst other famous artists.
Excuse me? Excuse me? A, she's a famous artist. He should be buried with her. B, they were married. Like, for all the tumultuous stuff going on in their relationship, like, what? Also, his dying wishes? Like, I think you'd want to respect that, maybe?
Just because you said something when you were dying doesn't mean people will do it when you're dead.
I guess not. And you know, this has happened before on this podcast, so I guess the lesson we have to take away from this is that make sure you have a trusted friend or five to make sure that when you're dying, you actually, you know, get put where you want to be.
Who else in this podcast didn't have their final wishes?
Man, I don't remember at this point, but there's definitely been, like, a woman who was like, yeah, I want to be buried next to my one true love who's also a woman. And they were like, nah, you're going in the family plot, you know?
Right, wasn't there somewhere one who wanted to be buried somewhere else, but they still put her next to her husband?
Ooh, no, it's trivia competition for the listeners. This body was buried in the wrong place. Love how multiple historical women's bodily autonomy gets ignored after their death.
Anyway, it didn't take long for a Frida Kahlo museum to open in 1958. Oddly, her ashes were put in a sack and placed on her old bed in the museum.
This makes me so mad. She specifically wanted to be cremated so she wouldn't be lying in a bed, and here she is. They've put her in a bed again.
In her old bed.
Yeah. Oh my god. It's like, have these people no sense of, like, poetry and respect?
The ashes are not there anymore or in a sack. They are somewhere else, so there is that. And like many, her work gained more attention after her death. Some paintings now sell for several million dollars.
I should note, if you're listing things that have her, there's also in Kentucky a Frida Kahlo themed mezcal and tequila bar that I went to one time. And of course the infinite pieces of jewelry and, you know, backpacks and shirts and whatever with her face.
Yeah, her face is just proliferated. I'm not sure if that is as a result of the film or a combination, but you can now find her visage everywhere. Thank you for listening. Follow us wherever you listen or on Twitter. And remember, if terrible things happen to you, make macabre art.